The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thank you, Rob, and other folks who are involved in putting those streams together. I think they're critically important. So this, what I'm gonna talk through a bit is comes out of a couple projects that I'm working on now. One on populism, contemporary populism, and one on what I argue is the increasing importance of the division between mental and manual labor in sort of political and social organization in the 20th century. And so part of this, the sort of brief part that I'll run through at the very beginning, is trying to look at the kind of growth of racial liberalism in the United States in the context of sort of this division between mental and manual labor. And then the thing I'll spend a little more time talking about tries to build on that, but also comes out of this recent, my reading of this recent essay by Cedric Johnson in the journal Catalyst, which is called, I believe, The Panthers Won't Save Us. And he argues there, as well as in an earlier book, that sort of the Black Power movement needs to be abandoned, and we should move towards some kind of much more universal populist movement. And so reading that sort of reminded me of Nikhil Singh's sort of suggestion that the Black Panthers, in fact, were populists. So that's kind of what I take up and try to do in the later part. So this first bit, I'm just going to sort of make more or less a series of claims about racial liberalism. If you're interested in them, I can try to say more about them. I can say more about them in the discussion. So, racial liberalism as the official anti-racism of the post-war U.S. state involved what Jody Melamed has called a professionalization of race relations. Racism was conceptualized as a form of individual pathology, and its cure was to be a pedagogical form of social engineering administered by liberal professionals. In this way, racial liberalism reconfigured white power and control by identifying it with the enlightened professionalism of the mental laborer ostensibly free from prejudice. The inverse side of this heroic white knowledge worker was a dual pathologization of, on the one hand, white Southerners and later white manual workers in general, understood as inordinately prone to racial prejudice, if also potentially redeemable. On the other hand, blacks, as the victims of racism, were read as constituted by that pathology. So you get this discourse ultimately of the culture of poverty, for example. If this portrayal was partially intended by liberals as a strategy to compel the deracializing of state policy, quote, and this is a quote from Naomi Morikawa, by making black people seem damaged or potentially violent, so we've really got to fix this because this is happening. It was also coincident with a long racializing tradition that placed non-whites on the margins of liberal civilization as a form of unruly nature against which such civilization must be defended. A pathological culture of poverty ultimately legitimated escalating regimes of militarized policing, surveillance, and incarceration that mirrored a whole set of post-colonial policing maneuvers in the non-Western world. This evolution of racial liberalism overlapped with a long history of the production and reproduction of a black brokerage stratum of educated representatives. The system of Negro schools was one of the few lasting remnants, for example, of radical Reconstruction. And so you can kind of trace this through to E. Franklin Frazier's argument, sort of mocking of the black bourgeoisie for not recognizing that sort of mental labor without the support of capital was largely powerless. In the crises of the 1970s, the threat of an increasingly radical civil rights movement and a nascent conservative backlash led racial liberalism towards a more genuine incorporation of a select or selected minority of non-whites into the stratum of empowered mental laborers. This liberal multiculturalism underwrote the contemporary hegemony of what Amani Perry called correlational racism. Apparent membership in a racial group is no longer viewed as necessitating the possession of certain unfavorable traits, but it's taken as a likely sign of them. Rounds of credential and cultural testing can disprove that likeliness, identifying one as a more or less proper, if still provisional, member in a meritocratic, multicultural, professional form of quote-unquote whiteness. This, what Melamed calls this partial detachment of race from skin color, both bolstered the ideology of post-racialism and produced the historically novel situation in which, quote, a minority of blacks wields significant political power and authority over the majority of black bloc, quote from Taylor's From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. Finally, this partial fusion of whiteness with the authoritative controlling position of mental labor renews the dual pathologies of racial liberalism. The majority of blacks and other non-whites, immigrants, Muslims, etc., are consigned to a marginalized, precarious, pathologized existence divorced from a supposedly resolved civil rights history. Likewise, any sign of ongoing privatized racism, as well as the rationale for avoiding any substantive efforts to redress racial inequalities, are attributed to a now permanently pathologized white working class. So that's the quick sketch of the evolution of racial liberalism, and now I turn to this issue of the Black Panther Party populism. Sketched in this way, the historical outcome of racial liberalism largely overlaps with Cedric Johnson's account over the last decade, revolutionaries give way to race leaders. His account of that trajectory is most convincing, to me at least, in his 2007 book called From Revolutionaries to Race Leaders, which focuses primarily on the deadlocks that haunted the various conferences intended to formulate national black political agendas in the U.S., across the spectrum from left to liberal. Such efforts compelled to identify some outcome generally did lend to black liberals the facade of speaking on behalf of the assembled community. It was liberals whose organizations functioned naturally at a national level as persuasive voices vis-a-vis the federal state, who were most comfortable with and adept at the kind of elite race brokerage apparatus, as Johnson called it, and who could present themselves pragmatically as the most likely to wield persuasive force or to gain electoral office. In such contexts, and this is a quote from Johnson, the race unity ideal often mystified the extent of political differences among blacks. In his recent essay, however, he insists that groups like the Panthers were intrinsically an element of this trajectory towards race leaders. Quote, black power militancy and the managerial logic of the great society were symbiotic. Yet I think Johnson has trouble stabilizing his account of the grounds of that symbiosis. In the end, he seems to assert that simply assert that the essentially liberal idea of black unity simply became a form of overwhelming common sense, shaping black power politics and leaving it nowhere to go other than some form of elite representation. Even the apparently revolutionary character of anti-colonial politics in groups like the Panthers, he suggests, parses out into a commensurate politics of a unifying national liberation. Symbiosis, then, here takes the form of a monolithic hegemony asserting itself without meaningful contradictions. Yet, I think that the contradictions in the period Johnson's talking about were actually numerous. Not only were the Panthers, for example, explicitly opposed to black nationalism and oriented by a form of class analysis and anti-capitalism, which Johnson argues was not part of the black power conception. But the Great Society's programs were also often enormous sites of contention, not a seamless formation of a new black elite stratum. As Karen Ferguson has shown, the 1964 Community Action Program, to which Johnson attributes that formation of a black elite stratum, was actually broadly viewed as a failure by white elites, having produced dissensus rather than orderly leadership and administration. Elite disenchantment with the community oversight and control aspects that CAP required motivated a shift to the presciently neoliberal model of community development corporations, in which advocacy for and by the poor was supplanted ultimately by the goal of doing little more than fostering individual minority leaders and their meritocratic inclusion in the American elite. So while this might seem a trivial matter, like Johnson says it was CAP and Ferguson says it was CDC, its importance, I think, lies in the way that his account simply constantly presents as intrinsic to the trajectory of black liberation movements what in fact emerged out of defeats in conflicts between black power groups and community groups and state elites. These conflicts were resolved not by community activists' embrace of elite representation, but by elites' capacity to withdraw or withhold funding, to form new initiatives of their own volition, and to determine beforehand the amount and forms of participation by non-state actors. And again, this distinction is important, I think, because in a sense you learn something different from a defeat than you learn from a sort of necessary internal capitulation. So that by omitting the participatory ethos of these movements, their opposition to traditional forms of leadership, Johnson makes an imposed outcome appear like a symbiosis. After all, if the Panthers were actually symbiotic with the Great Society, why was the coercive apparatus of the state brought to bear so squarely upon them? Nikhil Singh's account of the Panthers, I think, helps explain that coercive repression by challenging the idea that the Panthers' conception of unity was a mere copy of liberal hegemony. Rather, it explicitly asserted a potential people that exceeded the sovereignty and assimilative capacity of the state, referencing all those who suffered the effects of colonialism and capitalism, or the effects of racial capitalism, the social hierarchies and exclusions it had established, while also naming an intention to delegitimize, supplant, and replace the state itself, to demonstrate in practice its failures to make good on the unity that it promised. In their policing of the police, as in their survival programs, which focused on issues of social reproduction, and the establishment of their own foreign policy, quote, this is a quote from Singh, the Panthers signaled something far more dangerous than is generally acknowledged, the eruption of a non-state identity into the everyday life of the state. At its most prosaic and eloquent, as Singh puts it, Black Power's meaning was, quote, the refusal to concede the right of Black people to take initiative even under the most unfavorable circumstances. And it was that refusal that, while constituting a kind of provisional unity, also opened up a culture of initiative and participation that could rhyme with, draw support from, and support in turn, other struggles in other places. As Huey Newton put it, what united the people was, quote, the desire to run their own communities. Not a pre-given unity, but the aspiration for freedom that did not turn into another alibi for imperialist ordering enforced by an expert knowledge separated from the communities themselves. The people were those in a position of internal exclusion, or what Sotman Verdi calls the racialized outsider, whose unfreedom is constitutive of liberal universalism. Another quote from Singh, Black political life has been marked by the opposite movement, the generation of new universals from the forcible enclosures of racial stigma. So here I want to suggest that Singh's suggestion that the Black Panthers were populist actually can be taken further than he does himself. When this comes up in his book, as in his essay on the Black Panthers, this is just sort of a brief aside or even a footnote where he largely just refers to the Plow's early work on populism and suggests that the Panthers were carrying out kind of a novel form of popular representation that involved this broader kind of identity not nationally defined in relation to some specific state, or at least not wholly defined by that relation. But I think that his larger discussion of the Panthers also overlaps in interesting ways with Lord Grattan's recent suggestion that we need a notion of populism that's not just about this question of discursive representation, but that also focuses on populist institutions and practices. On the work of, and these are a few quotes from Grattan's book, building new, more resilient forms of democratic power and empowering actors to wield them, of developing strategies for transforming large-scale economic, social, and governmental institutions, and of generating more elastic relations between members of competing social groups. So then, the radicalism of Singh's account of the Black Panthers and its account of a potential kind of radical form of left populism, I think, turn in this can be glimpsed in this context in two elements of Singh's discussion. First, it imagines populism, the opening movement of which is the delegitimation of state power and the enactment of its potential dissolution. Rather than enshrining popular sovereignty in the state or in some leader, the Panthers sought to weaken the state, to lay bare the limits of its power, and to take over key functions in participatory modes. Another quote from Singh, by refusing to recognize the status of policing as it operated within Black communities, the Panthers effectively nullified police power and substituted themselves as its alternative, end quote. Their survival programs, I would argue, played a similar role in relation to the institutions of the welfare state. They were not in symbiosis with the great society. They were meant to supplant it, in other words. Second, by articulating the notion of the people that began from the racialized outsider, from those perpetually subject to forms of policing where relations of force take primacy over law, reduced to a position of surplus labor while work is declared a condition of social work, the Panthers articulated a popular identity that fundamentally breaks the liberal link between freedom and sovereignty and the inheritance of settler colonialism. It is precisely because racialized outsiders are located on the excluded inside of political society that their vision of popular sovereignty, at least in the form the Panthers articulated it, posits a potential break with both state-imposed forms of order and the violently appropriative racialized character of capitalism that the state enforces. Johnson, to return to Johnson for a minute, what Johnson insists is that we ought to have this form of popular politics or populism that he argues should turn on the state's management of an increasing surplus population rather than racism, he suggests, because it's that management of the surplus population that is, he argues, the root cause of the contemporary policing and incarceration crisis. Thus, we should reckon with, he argues, we should reckon with the systematic production and reproduction of a surplus population by the contemporary mode of capitalist accumulation and develop an analysis that would treat the black urban poor not as separate and unique, but as a dramatic manifestation of the precarity that defines working class life more generally. Again, a quote from Johnson. But in my view, the idea that framing the issue in some pure terms of capitalism and class would underpin a broader popular support obscures the extent to which the production and reproduction of a surplus population and racialization are inextricably linked. From the Indian Wars to the policing of slave populations, from the enforced economic and political marginalization of former slaves to the systems of militarized policing of former and present colonies, the identification, the management, and the reproduction of surplus populations are shaped by the invention and reinvention of race. Those populations can neither be properly understood nor mobilized without a direct confrontation with the procedures of racialization. If we are to ever forge sustainable solidarity between the ethnically diverse proletariat and the imperialist core, as well as those beyond, as Satmanbirdi puts it, it is more likely that we will have to go through race rather than around it. The potential for such solidarity is heightened, I think, by the dual trajectories of race and class today. On the one hand, the racialization and feminization of the working class and surplus populations. On the other hand, the increasing identification of the traditional spaces of whiteness with a multicultural or cosmopolitan form of mental labor drawing its power from capital. No doubt Johnson is right to caution us regarding how easily projects of the racialized working class can be usurped by the control of the stratum of representative knowledge workers. So what we can learn from him is the centrality of opposition to the ostensibly neutral powers of mental labor in contemporary politics, expertise, meritocracy, and so on. But the argument does not flow the other way. The processes of racialization, the specific forms of excessive violence that underpin the productions of surplus and low-wage populations, cannot be overcome by an appeal to neutral abstractions of class struggles any more than by the post-racialism of liberal professionals. Efforts to nullify that excessive violence in its specificity and replace it with communal agency can translate across different racialized communities. This was the lesson of the Chicago Panthers' original Rainbow Coalition, but that violence cannot be effectively deracinated. In the era of Trumpism as, quote, a promise to resupply the wages of whiteness in the absence of wages, the struggle of racialized outsiders must be at the center of left struggles, even or especially their populist forms.
see everyone. Some nice to see unfamiliar faces, but also familiar faces from a lot of different places, including summer camp, where some of this work was first begun, and also a couple of people from Berkeley, which I rarely get a chance to put up pictures of my hometown, but there's one. My hometown is basically a bunch of people standing around a dumpster. Sometimes it's on fire. And I think this paper chimes in several ways with Michael's. Among the many anniversaries we're having this year, it's the 50th anniversary of the long, hot summer of 1967, a year which saw more than 160 so-called race riots, a rubric as historically misleading and politically mystifying as it is significant and suggestive of the changing dynamics of social contest. It's these dynamics and their relation to capital's internal transformations and external limits as it moves along what I name as the arc of accumulation on into the present to which this talk turns. Racial Anti-Capitalism, Detroit 67. Arguably a misleading title since we'll spend a brief time in 1967 Detroit and more of it in the present, I think. That capitalism is racial through and through is by now a matter of only limited dispute. That this has ever been the case animates the so-called new histories of capital, assaying the extent to which the takeoff of capitalism and its success as a system organizing social arrangement has been premised on racialized dispossession, on the plunder of resources, and the broad use of unfree labor. And further, the extent to which these processes have been both premised on and part of the production of race. As I am from the provinces, as you can tell by my accent, I must note that while this case is made at a global level, the United States, with the trajectory of chattel slavery, has become a paradigmatic case. Wagelessness, we might agree, is at the origin of systematic capitalism and indeed at the origin of the wage. Moreover, even as these processes are ongoing, the production of differential citizenship as a basis for valuation of labor power in the era of more and less free labor remains both a basis for capital's profitability and for racialization. Ruth Wilson Gilmore describes racism, which we might call racialization, as, here I quote, the state-sanctioned or extra-legal production and exploitation of group-differentiated vulnerability to premature death. This activity is constitutive of how capital proceeds. It remains a matter of debate whether this allows for a single system interpretation wherein capitalism explains racism, or demands a dual system interpretation with race and racism, along with gender and patriarchy, of course, among other bases of differential citizenship, grasped as a socially autonomous force. This debate is indeed at the origin of the term racial capitalism itself, being the motivating force of Cedric Robinson's Black Marxism, the making of the Black radical tradition, the work which first expanded the term racial capitalism from an account of specific local developments to a description of capitalism as such. Now, I do not think that this single dual systems debate needs to be resolved for the purposes of the present discussion. Nonetheless, its irresolution might be understood as part of an explanation for some of the ways in which race and class are opposed. Here, I do not mean to confront a certain recondite kind of class reductionism which seems, for the most part, nostalgic. This is no more interesting than the posing of race as itself a groundless ontological ground for social contest, a position which, among other things, presupposes a kind of unsustainable American exceptionalism. However, there is a more common and popular consequence of the opposition, which is the inability to recognize racialized struggles as being a form of class struggle. Not class struggle really, but class struggle as well, of which this brief passage is exemplary. It describes a prolonged confrontation between gathered alt-right and neo-fascist forces and largely local anti-fascists in April of this year. There's, of course, talked to an FBI agent, as one always must, who says he's shocked by the news reports he was seeing online about Berkeley. He thought, this isn't a riot, it's basically low-level political warfare in the streets of an American city. Shocked. The basis of this distinction, low-level political warfare versus riot, is self-evidently one of race. The former marked as white, in part by a peculiar fantasy about who is engaged in anti-fascist and black bloc actions, but that's another story, and the latter marked as black. My larger argument, as some will know, is that this extends the long tradition of treating the riot, racialized since the 19th century in the U.S. and decisively marked as black since at least the 60s, much as it is now marked proper to immigrants across Western Europe, as a non- or sub-political spontaneous upwelling, spasmodic, to use a term popular among early historians, a term roundly mocked by E.P. Thompson some decades ago, to treat the social phenomenon vitriolically by conservatives and paternalistically at best by most leftists, but rarely if ever understood as central to what class struggle looks like now. In trying to think about this curious misapprehension, it is hard not to be drawn to Detroit, and especially Detroit around 1967, a locus both extraordinary and exemplary. Detroit, a center of the auto industry and thus of US industrialism's hub and imaginary, has several salient features. It is the modern center of organized labor and monument to deindustrialization, site of dynamic domestic and international immigration, and runway for white flight. It is the US city where class and race appear most closely and most often in opposition. One might consider the great film Blue Collar, released in 1978, shot among other places at Ford's River Rouge plant, host to the first black belt strike in U.S. history in 1943. The three proletarian heroes, two black and one white, set out against both auto company and the corrupt union in the most brutal strand of the narrative, a federal agent working on behalf of both institutions endeavors to destroy the trio according to racial divisions, more or less effectively. The narrative wherein racial particularism unmakes the solidarity of class universalism is a commonplace, needless to say, of old left hostility to what is sometimes called identity politics, though the film itself is far more thoughtful about the realities of this set of tensions than any Manichaean politics can manage. But other things are happening in Detroit in 1967, two in particular bear attention here. On the one hand, the most radical black labor organizing in recent memory is in motion, with the figures who will in the next year found DRUM, the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, and then the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. A year earlier, the Detroit Black Panther Party for Self-Defense is founded and expands swiftly. These developments both have their bases in material shifts. On the one hand, a still dominant manufacturing economy internalizing black labor, wherein, according to one anonymous chronicler, quote, the black revolution of the 1960s had finally arrived at one of the most vulnerable links of the American economic system, the point of mass production, the assembly line. On the other, the force of this arrival had been prompted by the traditional unions, whose seniority system effectively, quote, gave legal force to the white male monopoly of the better jobs. Alongside this limit, the industrial economy had begun its decline, and found itself unable to absorb in full the demographic influx, which significantly includes a massive immigrant population of Middle Eastern laborers. These factors together imply an increase in both employed and surplus black populations, subject to differential dispossessions. But these tendencies are moving in opposite directions. In the period 65 to 73, the trend lines cross like wires sparking, and Detroit sees the intensification of conditions for riot and strike centered within the black community. Let's let them find seats.
Sorry.
No worries. How are you, sir?
Hi.
Good. In the end, it will be the Great Rebellion of 1967, a riot like and unlike any other, which will be the signal event, a foretaste of politics to come. This is the situation as the 60s accelerate and the basis for the political sequences that unfold, even if they cannot endure. The great oddity of the situation, not terribly relevant to my argument herein, but too fascinating to ignore, is that the organizing committees for both DRUM and the Panthers comprise the exact same set of personnel, with John Watson leading both. Both of these rising trajectories will swiftly crash back down again. The League effectively dissolves in 1972, passing on what spirit remains to the Communist League, while the Detroit Panthers had already been disbanded in 1970 on orders from Chicago, specifically for being too close to laborist modes of politics. the scene in 1967 is more or less a crucible of the relations between two different politics, which we might call the politics of the wage and the wageless. And yet it continues to be the case that the former is far easier to recognize as a politics, even when race is prioritized. In the 1967 essay, The White Blind Spot, wherein the idea of white privilege is first formulated under the name white skin privilege, authors Ignatieff and Allen, negotiating a series of debates arising from SDS and its divisions, argue that the white worker, rather than identifying blacks as having a parallel fight, must struggle immediately against white chauvinism. This is necessary not out of some ethical obligation to anti-racism, but because white privilege in fact damages conditions and possibilities for white workers as well. The differential valuation of black lives allows for the driving down of white wages in ways that are not compensated for by the wages of whiteness. Thus, racial politics are understood as a basis for class solidarity, already better than the class reductionists of the present, but this logic is founded on the presence of the wage and a relatively taut labor market. It is already apparent to some that this situation could not last. In 1963, James Boggs, himself a Detroit auto worker, notes a developing opposition, union-mediated, not between labor and capital, or between blacks and whites, but between the employed and those without jobs, driven by industrial automation and the inability of other sectors to absorb all those displaced. In Detroit, 1958, he writes, the unemployed began to pick at birth the plans of the union against overtime. He gives an account of this picket action and notes in conclusion, thus the union has itself drawn the line between the employed and the unemployed. This historical development animates the significance of Boggs' most trenchant maxim, America is headed toward full unemployment, not full employment. The course of capital imposes wagelessness just as it imposes the wage, and moreover, these impositions move unevenly and in different directions. It behooves us now to consider the same set of questions about race, class, wage, unemployment, and what counts as politics from the far end of the long crisis, which was just beginning when Ignatieff and Allen wrote The White Blind Spot and Detroit burned. We might divide the world into two fundamental modes of global capital: absorption and coloniality. The former is present on the drive and on the capacity to internalize new labor inputs to productive processes, with liberal democracy as the form of managementality. You can tell this is the entire fundament of liberal democracy. It's written on the Statue of Liberty. There's that poem, and it says, we will internalize new labor. It says it in a sort of fanciful way, as poets are inclined to do, but it's pretty straightforward, right? So there's that mode of absorption, which features the wage as a form of discipline and indirect domination. The latter, coloniality, is premised on extraction rather than widening exploitation, and thus requires direct domination. Marx and Fanon, crudely speaking. This is a rough model, but a useful one, I hope. It allows us to see that as Boggs' unemployment grows, what we these days call stagnant surplus population, deindustrializing nations must creep and lurk toward a kind of neo-colonial discipline, of which hyper-incarceration is the most evident example. That hyper-incarceration is racialized is the most obvious fact on offer. Given its basis in exclusion from the wage, it in turn clarifies or provides a shorthand for the racialization of unemployment itself, as well as the pseudo-employment of schemes like zero-hours contracts, which are just now approaching 1 million in the UK, with a heavily racialized constituency. This, in turn, is a reflection of the situation at a global level. In rich countries, 1/3 of workers lack standard employment. In middle-income countries, 86% of workers lack standard employment. And in low-income countries, 94%. What, then, can we say about the present? Our answers here can only be telegraphic and provisional. We begin from the non-identity of the working class and the proletariat, less evident in 1967 than it is now. We might recognize that if there is to be a political unity at a practical level, of which solidarity is an expression but not a constitutive one, it will be among the wageless first, toward which the wage will orient themselves one way or another. Given that unemployment is organized not just at a global level but locally according to race, struggles organized by the principle of exclusion from the wage, by the class of the excluded, are certain to appear as racialized struggles, and this will be a true appearance. Struggles in the US, for example, around blackness and in forms available to those outside labor markets will need to be recognized as class struggle, not in the first instance, and yet absolutely. Politics will be premised on this recognition that every riot is low-intensity class warfare, or maybe not so low. That is to say, finally, that the situation is the obverse of that sketched in the white blind spot. Even as they correctly grasp that race is not the blockage to class unity but its basis, it is because of race's relation not to the wage, but its absence. In turn, the premise of racial capitalism's basis in wagelessness now returns with an understanding that wagelessness is the basis for our new class politics we might name as racial anti-capitalism. Thank you very much.
So I don't know exactly how I ended up on this pile, because I'm not going to be talking about black power in the 60s or 70s. But if you can figure out the connection by the end of the talk, fantastic. I bet you can. Was that? Yeah, that's right. Be that as it may, I'm going to talk about the influence of this guy, Will Herbert, on Du Bois while he was working on Black Reconstruction in America. Everybody's heard of Du Bois, of course. How many have heard of Will Herbert? Little sort of, kind of, not too many. No worries, by the end of the talk, you'll know all about him. I should step back and sort of tell you what some of the background questions that got me into this particular line of research are, were. One of them, and I don't plan to answer these today, by the way, what I'm going to say, I hope, is a contribution towards answering them. How did Du Bois become a Marxist? There have been a lot of scholars who, I think, try to take a stab at this. I don't find any of their explanations fully satisfying. So I think there are some missing elements, in particular, some of the intellectual influences on Du Bois. I think this particular episode in Du Bois's development is illuminating towards this wider question. Yeah, how to become a Marxist, more specifically a Stalinist. And specifically, how to work in the Black Reconstruction impact his political trajectory. So again, I'm not going to answer these directly. If folks want to know how this particular project fits into this, I'd be happy to discuss that more in the discussion. My main argument today, well, I've got a few of them. I'll start with the first. You have to start with the first. Yeah, okay. And that's that. Herbert was a significant influence on Du Bois' magnum opus, overlooked in scholarship on both thinkers. Herbert is really not mentioned in the scholarship on Du Bois. I think there's maybe one page in Lewis's monumental biography of Du Bois where he mentions that they became friends in this period, but there's no intimation that he was actually a significant intellectual influence. Folks who've written about Herbert, and there's not that many, not nearly as many, have noted interesting parallels between the two thinkers' ideas, but no one's made a connection that there was actually causal influence going from Herbert to Du Bois. I think it went both ways, but the arrow from Herbert to Du Bois also is just not in the lit. So hopefully I'm going to try to convince you that this was actually happening. just a little bit of sort of the political and intellectual context for Du Bois's work on block reconstruction. This is not new, so folks who are familiar with Du Bois, sort of canon around Du Bois, this will be a refresher, but hopefully it'll encapsulate in a way that's helpful about what I'm going to say, what I'm going to add to the story. So Du Bois flirted with socialism as a young man when he was studying in Germany. He attended SPD meetings. As Adolf Reed has argued, Du Bois was also influenced by what were sometimes called collectivist intellectual currents in the United States, some of which were more radical than others, but all of which saw future progress lying in greater state intervention in the economy, more rational planning. And it's important to recall that many of the founders of the NAACP, which of course Du Bois was one and was a towering figure within for many years, many decades, were themselves socialists, folks like Mary Washington White, etc. So again, this is part of Du Bois's milieu. And Du Bois himself joined the Socialist Party in the early 19-teens. Didn't stay around very long, in part because the party was many in the party were soft on racism, in terms of their understanding of Reconstruction specifically, intellectuals associated with the Socialist Party, folks like Aldi Simon, tended to view Reconstruction as a capitalist plot, and Du Bois always found these intellectuals' analysis of the period unsatisfying. I don't think that's why he left the party, but just in terms of how this sort of brief sojourn in the Socialist Party influences thinking about Reconstruction, the answer is not much. If anything, he recoiled from it. Du Bois, of course, became sympathetic to the Soviet Union after the Russian Revolution. He visited the Soviet Union in 1926 and was impressed. He nevertheless remained skeptical of prospects for interracial labor organizing in the United States. Certainly didn't see what happened in Russia as a recipe or a blueprint for what could or should happen in the United States. He had intense clashes with the Communist Party of the United States over theory and over tactics, in particular around the Scottsboro Boys, right? Because Du Bois is a leading figure in NAACP during the fight around the Scottsboro Boys. Everyone's familiar with the Scots, hopefully. Yeah. And the CP harshly criticized the NAACP for its handling of that case, and Du Bois thought that the Black Belt thesis, which was advocated by the Comintern and adopted, although arguably not fully, by the Communist Party, at least rhetorically it was adopted, Du Bois thought it was wrong-headed.
The what thesis?
The Black Belt thesis. I'm sorry. Yeah, the idea that blacks constituted a nation within certain states of the South and would therefore have the right of declaring independence and forming their own republic along the lines of what various national minorities in the Soviet Union had done. Sorry, yeah. If any of this stuff's not clear, stop me or we can talk more in the discussion. The only reason I'm skirting over kind of fast is because I'm not really adding anything to the story. I'm just kind of encapsulating, but again, feel free. Be happy to embellish. Du Bois undertook an intensive study of Marxism during the early 1930s, specifically from 32 to 34. This is not intended to be patronizing, but Du Bois' understanding of Marxism was actually pretty cursory up until this point. The things that he had written up to this point about Marxism didn't reflect any sort of deep engagement with Marx or with Marxist texts. But he tried to make up for lost time in a hothouse atmosphere in the early 30s. In part, this was spurred by the Great Depression, which causes a series of interrelated crises in American society, insurgencies in the working class, including the Black working class, also a crisis of the NAACP itself, with which Du Bois is associated. There's a financial crisis in the organization, the thing almost collapses entirely, but also there's a deep intellectual ferment within the NAACP. In particular, there's a challenge to the old guard leadership of the NAACP by a group called the Young Turks, which includes folks like Abram Harris, Ralph Bunche, Franklin Frazier, Emmett Dorsey, and others. Many of them worked at Howard University. These folks were supportive of interracial unionism and critical of an idea associated with Du Bois, although Du Bois was beginning to break from it already, the idea of the talented tenth, that sort of a segment of the Black elite would be the salvation of Blacks as a group. Du Bois is also influenced by a group of white leftist intellectuals in this period, folks like B.F. Calverton, Benjamin Stolberg, the journalist, and also, as I'll argue, Will Herberg. We can talk more about these folks if you're interested. Other important influences, and they're not really specific to this period, but they're just long-standing influences that I want to recognize. Carter Woodson and his Journal of Negro History, Association for Study of African American History and Life, in particular, the emphasis on black agency that shines through in Black Reconstruction comes largely from this intellectual influence, to which Du Bois himself had already contributed beginning as early as the 1910s. So the main argument I'm going to make today, so that's all sort of like I'm taking some of that as read, but again, happy to embellish any particular points. Herberg was a significant influence on Du Bois, overlooking the scholarship of both thinkers. Who's Herberg? Right, that's the big question. All right. He's a Jewish immigrant to the United States. He's born in Russia, moved to Brooklyn when he was a kid. Secular Jew. Went to Boys High School. Any Brooklynites here? Nobody? All right, Boys High School is still around, I think. Did you rename it? Forget it. He was sort of like a child prodigy wunderkind kind of thing. Excelled in everything. He was fluent in English, Hebrew, German, French. According to some accounts, also Latin and Greek. He supposedly, according to his brother, read the complete works of Freud in German as a smart guy. Went to City College in New York. Although he flunked out, he failed phys ed, and was apparently expelled after an argument with some. This is back when there was mandatory military training in public schools, and he got in an argument with somebody, something about swimming laps, and he's like, no, I don't have to do it. Uncle Sam can't make me swim laps. I don't know the details, but it's all shrouded in mystery. He joined the Communist Party youth group as a young man. We don't know exactly when. Quickly rose through the ranks and became a director of agitprop, which is like the 1920s equivalent of dank meme stash generator or something. I guess. And as you see, he became a member of the editorial committee of the Worker. I have a dank meme coming up, just wait. He was expelled from the Communist Party of the United States with the Lovestoneites in 1929. How many folks have heard of the Lovestoneites? Whether or not you heard of Herbert. All right, same people have heard Herbert. Great. Formerly known as the Communist Party Opposition, and here's some of the leading figures, all what we today would recognize as white guys, not all women considered white back then, or not fully white, also known as the Lovestoneites after J. Lovestone. These folks, again, I don't want to go into too much of a tangent, they were expelled from the communist movement because they were critical of Stalin's imposition of the third period, in which Stalin argued that there was going to be an intensification of class struggles and sort of everything. Revolution was on the immediate agenda, and parties needed to get with that and criticize anyone slightly to the right as being counter-revolutionary and akin to fascists. That sounds a little crazy. It was. These folks said so. They were pretty small. They had a few hundred members. They were quite influential in New York City in the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. Charles Sasha Zimmerman was a major figure in Local 22 of the ILGWU. So they actually had a base in the labor movement. They were, despite their sort of a heavy-handed treatment by Stalin, they were staunch defenders of the Soviet Union. However, they argued that each communist party in different parts of the world needed latitude to develop their own independent sort of tactics and strategy for how to deal with the conditions on the ground. They had sort of a toy international. They really only had four. I mean, they're pretty small in the States, but they didn't really have much going on in other countries. If you're curious, we can talk a little bit more about it. Probably the most important international section outside the U.S. was in Spain, the PUM. Folks are familiar with the sort of Spanish Civil War. No, the PUM was influenced in part by the Lovestoneites and their ideas. The main theoreticians of the group were Bert Wolff over there, and Herbert. The group disbanded in 1940. They were dismayed by the Hitler-Stalin pact. Say a little bit about the look.
We got time. You've got seven minutes.
Oh crap! Really?
All right. I'll try.
Speed up a little. So the Lebsonites had a distinctive analysis and strategy around race. They believed that African Americans were not a nation, as the Communist Party USA asserted following the Comintern, but rather they were what they called a caste. And they didn't mean this in a really narrow sense. They meant caste in a loose sense, similar to Jews in Russia and untouchables in India, but what we today call a racialized minority. They argued that the oppression of African Americans was rooted in pre-capitalist holdovers, relics of the slave past, which capitalism then latched onto and became and benefited from. And from that, they derived the strategic conclusion that black liberation requires socialist revolution, since capitalism itself is now so deeply invested in the subordination of African Americans. They argued that, practically speaking, socialists had to be in the forefront of fights against all manifestations of racism within the labor movement and the wider society. They actually built a significant black cadre, in particular in Harlem. Again, if I had more time, I'd tell you more about them. If you're curious, just ask. They had a magazine devoted specifically to, or oriented specifically around African American issues, as well as a journal. The journal came a little later in the period I'm talking about. Du Bois and the Lebsonites. So, early 1930s, Du Bois, as editor of The Crisis, established a sort of a magazine exchange program with the Lebsonites. So, they were intellectually influencing one another, at least to some extent. So at least some people who were in the offices of these publications were receiving each other's work. Herbert published his first article in The Crisis as early as 1931. That was a decision that Du Bois made to publish Herbert. They had extensive correspondence for several years, during which the ideas behind Black Reconstruction are taking more concrete shape. They commented on each other. And interestingly, there was an attempt to suppress the Lebsonites newspaper. Du Bois publicly decried this, although he was kind of hands-offish when it came to invitations to speak on platforms organized by the Lebsonites. So he's sort of friendly in a principled way, exchanging ideas, but not committing it by any means. I'm not arguing that Du Bois was a Lebsonite or anything like that. So getting back to the main argument here. So Herbert wrote a Marxist analysis of the Civil War and Reconstruction, which is actually cited four times in Black Reconstruction America and quoted three times. The publication was called The Heritage of the Civil War. It originally appeared in something called The Modern Quarterly, edited by Calverton, I mentioned earlier. It was reprinted as a pamphlet by the Lebsonites. And Du Bois thought it was great, a fine piece of work and absolutely true. Pretty high praise. We should all have our work described as fine and absolutely true by some of the statutory Du Bois, right? The analysis here. The Civil War was, according to Herbert, was fundamentally a conflict over slavery. So he cut right through all sort of lost cause nonsense. He argued that it was a world historic bourgeois revolution like the French. He pointed out that the Republican side, the North, was divided during Reconstruction. There were some radical Republicans who wanted land reform. However, most Northern capitalists feared any form of property redistribution. A lot of this is echoed, I think, in the recent scholarship of the period. He drew an analogy to what was happening in the United States, to what was going on, again, in France, and concluded that the absence of land reform during Reconstruction was the key failure that led to the entrenchment of black subordination. That was the key relic of the past that I talked about, that he thought entrenched black subordination into the up until the present, 1930s. He had a critique of the historiography, which is one of the things that actually Du Bois cited, against right-wingers. He dismissed all ideas of black intellectual and political inferiority, right, because part of the lost cause narrative is that black people were incompetent voters and politicians, they were corrupt and so forth. Herbert completely rejected this. And against those on the left, like I mentioned, there were intellectuals in the Socialist Party who thought that Reconstruction was a capitalist plot. Du Bois thought this was completely simplistic. He didn't think black subordination was a foregone conclusion. He thought the struggle could have turned out radically differently. And he argued that we should take inspiration from some of the abolitionist and radical Reconstruction leaders like Thad Stevens. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip over this slide. asked me if you're curious. Du Bois didn't copy word for word everything that was in Herbert's pamphlet. He was influenced by it. But yeah, he put his own spin on things. So this is my first point. Herbert also directed Du Bois to other Marxist writings on this period, some of which are cited heavily in Black Reconstruction. And there's a letter trail here where Du Bois is actually asking all of his sort of radical intellectual friends, so what should I read about this period? And folks like some of the Young Turks are like, well, there's not much to read. Herbert says, oh, no, there's plenty to read. You should really read Marx's writings on the U.S. Civil War, which were not well known at the time. Some of them have been published in fairly obscure left-wing journals, but Du Bois was clearly not familiar with them. And in the notes, well, suffice to say that Du Bois ends up reading and using a lot of the writings by Marx that Herbert recommended. Also some secondary literature, Socialist Party election named Schluter, who's cited multiple times in Berea in the Black Reconstruction. Again, if folks are curious, I can tell you more about this particular aspect. But long, 3 minutes, 2 minutes, something like that? The other thing, and this I'm a little less sort of, the word may appears here instead of fact, but I'm pretty sure about this. Herbert referred, he actually used this expression, psychic compensation, to describe the attachment of white working class people in the South to racist ideas. I'm pretty sure this actually inspired Du Bois's psychological wage formulation that many of you are probably familiar with in Black Reconstruction. Not the entire idea, but the specific formulation. Like that phrase, in other words. As people may know, this phrase, psychological wage, it doesn't appear anywhere else in Black Reconstruction, so we could debate about sort of how pivotal it is to the entire theoretical construct there. But I think the phrase itself probably comes from Herbert. In particular, there's this article that Herbert probably sent to Du Bois in draft, but in any event, he published it in a book that Du Bois also published in, an essay in that appeared early 1934 as Du Bois was finishing up the drafts of Black Reconstruction. Herbert argued, you can read it, nor can we underestimate the social significance of the feeling of racial superiority as a form of psychic compensation. It's not exactly the phrase, psychological wage, but it's about as close as you can get. And since Du Bois had never used this phrase before, and then publishes the book right after, and since Du Bois published an essay in the same book that this appeared in, and I'm almost positive, although not totally 100% certain, that Du Bois also read the essay in draft, there's strong reason to believe that this is where Du Bois, probably unconsciously, got the phrase. So I'm willing to stick my neck out a little bit. Yeah, Du Bois, read it, probably twice. Last slide, then I'm done. So why have scholars overlooked Herbert's influence? Here comes the dang meme. Influence on Du Bois' Black Reconstruction. For one thing, Herbert is cited in the chapter notes, but not in the actual bibliography at the end of the book. There's like an annotated bibliography at the end of the book where Du Bois says, oh, I read this, this sucked, this is really good, this is okay. Right, folks familiar? Read it, we'll know. But Herbert doesn't appear there. In part, I think, because this was a pamphlet and not a scholarly monograph, and it it was a little too obscure. But it's cited in the chapter notes, and that's how I picked up on it. Herbert is also omitted from Du Bois' selected correspondence, which is interesting, the published version, that is, which was edited by Herbert Apthicker. Connection? Apthicker, right, Du Bois' literary executor, was a hardcore Stalinist, and the only people that the Stalinists hated more than the Trotskyites were the Lovestonites. So there may have been a political reason why Herbert's correspondence with Du Bois in this period didn't make it into print. Hypothesis. And then also, Herbert himself became a hardcore right-winger in the 60s and 70s. He became a contributor to the National Review. Many of the Lovestonites followed this trajectory. They became sort of, they're so disillusioned with the Soviet Union around the time of the Hitler-Stalin Pact. They went through a sort of dramatic rethinking and soul-searching, and many of them ended up in the American foreign policy establishment. J. Lovestone himself, most famously, working with the CIA. Herbert, in terms of race, Herbert actually penned a critique of the civil rights movement for undermining law and order. So here's Ben Dean. Fitting for a conference in London. You guys know Monty Python, right? Okay, am I dating myself? No one comes left by our time. Nobody expects the right opposition. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for those really good three papers. We've got about 45 minutes for questions, comments, etc. Try to increase all of them in time, but I'll open.
Thank you very much for your presentations. I have a question for Michael and Joshua, and maybe like a comment for Matt. So I have to say I missed probably the 4 minutes of the beginning of your presentation, so I might have missed something over there. Two things. One is that I didn't get what is I would like to know that what is how do you differentiate or whether actually differentiate between populist and popular? I differentiate, and I think there are good historical reason and important political reason to actually differentiate between populist and popular. My reading and my understanding of Black Panthers is about popular, not populist. Even within the broader Black Americans at the time. The other thing is that you mentioned that in terms of like the Black Panthers' intervention in terms of the work, and you mentioned the way that they sort of like turn around like the question of policing and turn around the question of like community organizing and all those kind of things. And of course, this is the time that Johnson's war on poverty was also implemented in the quote-unquote Black ghetto. And here is what I want to kind of link the argument, like my argument and the comments sort of to Joshua's thing about the differentiation that you made between race riots and low intensity or political low intensity.
The FBI makes that thing. Yeah.
So, no, I know. I know that. But you were making it. You were making it that. Or my understanding was that you were saying that when it's about Black or non-white people, it's been called riots, and then in this case, because it was not. It was mostly white people, so they are calling it low intensity warfare. And there's a kind of new scholarship coming out on the history of it, coming out of the historians' history of community development, and that and also in international relations and in war, particularly in counterinsurgency critical leadership that are coming out, that traces so Johnson's war on poverty very much actually benefited from their pacification strategies in terms of the community development program, for example, pacification strategy in Vietnam, but also 30 years of history of community development programs that in the U.S. started in the Japanese internment camps. So I think it's important that the fact that the way that the state they did see Black Panther as a threat and as an enemy within, and the idea of like the war on poverty, and that they used actually a military strategy back into the quote unquote Black ghetto, and which I wanted to link to your presentation in terms of. I think the state always like saw this as war. Like when you look at the history of, and that's where I come from in terms of the history of the state intervention in what is being identified as problematic neighborhoods in quote unquote the ghettos from the U.S. to the U.K. Every after quote unquote race riots, there's a heavy state intervention here in the U.K. The urban programs that came out in the early 60s, right after the uprising in the mainly Black population uprising, for example, in Nottingham, and same also in the U.S. And the language that I've actually been used is when you get into the documents, it's very much actually close. They like the understanding of riot is war. So I just kind of want to like to point it to that. And quickly for Matt, I'm lost at understanding. What was the point? By and maybe just I got lost. So what was the point of pointing out, bringing in this history of influence of Herbert on Du Bois, and then you kind of ended up with, well, Herbert actually turned into a right winger.
Later.
Yeah, I know, but that's how you finish. So I kind of got lost in terms of like what I'm going to get this from here, but maybe that's one thing that you missed to say.
Hi, so I do have a comment for Matt, and I mean this in the most comradely fashion possible, but I am also a little bit kind of left as to what it is I'm supposed to take from this kind of, you know, intellectual history that you provided, and I'm a little bit, I guess, shaken just because I see the other papers as providing an analysis of Black intellectual labor. And then I see your paper that takes one of these towering figures of Black intellectual labor and is at pains to show the influence of, you know, this either partial or fully white man on the intellectual labor of Du Bois. And so I'm curious what the takeaway is supposed to be with that, especially when we speak about how, you know, historically, the intellectual labor of Black folk has been kind of often misappropriated or misattributed to other people. And so I'm just wondering where that kind of where that analysis was supposed to go. For Josh, I just wanted to ask...
Josh.
Sorry.
My mom called him.
Joshua.
Very bad.
For Joshua, I was just curious in terms of, you have these concepts of capitalist absorptive, colonial capital or extractive capital. You also talk about the non-identity of the working class and the proletariat. These are interesting distinctions, I think. I'm wondering, especially because I'm writing from Canada, you're writing from the U.S., we're both writing from settler colonial spaces, so where do Indigenous peoples fit into this? Because I think there are very kind of robust distinctions between Indigenous peoples and other racialized groups in the settler colonies, and I would often put Indigenous peoples in these kind of latter categories, right, as kind of they're not there for kind of to be absorbed into the wage labor force. They're there to be excluded distinctly. But if we're also placing other racialized groups there, then where do we distinguish further? Does that make sense?
I'm not sure I caught the very last move.
Okay, so from what I understood, you were placing racialized minorities in this latter category of colonial capital. No? Okay, so maybe you could just elaborate on that distinction a little bit more.
I see. Thanks.
Anyone else got anything to add?
Hi.
That's kind of a lot more.
Just want to say one more.
Okay. Is it the only one?
Yeah.
Okay, so I was listening to you talking about surplus populations, unwage, unemployed. It just occurred to me that perhaps it might be a good idea to start complicating this notion of surplus populations and their function as well, because it's not just the wage and the labor of actually producing or providing services or whatever, is it really in the end? There's a lot to do with consumption, which is, of course, the incarceration as well, and various other ways in which economy kind of spills into different spheres, economic crime, so on and so forth. So, and that's it.
So we'll run to the OB presenter.
Yeah, sure. In relation to this question about populist and popular, I don't know that I'll be able to offer any kind of argument in short time that convinces you or anybody else, but I've actually thought a good bit about this, because there are a lot of people who make this distinction. So Duramo, Enrique Dussel, Jody Dean, I believe, makes it too. I argue in part of a thing I'm working on, that distinction, while theoretically convincing in a lot of ways, because it's partially one of the things they're distinguished by from any theorists, for people who don't know these debates, is that populism presupposes a kind of unity that the popular doesn't, for example. Is that the same?
The unity of the people.
What?
The
unity
of the people.
So I think that while that argument is sort of theoretically convincing in a way, I'm also concerned that it theoretically predetermines what's possible in any specific movement. Because, in other words, I think that any movement is always that uses this kind of discourse of the people or a popular movement is always going to be, to some extent, both.
that is both what theorists distinguish as populist and popular. And so what I propose is just using populist as a term for all of them, that you then have to analyze what's going on in movement and what the dangers and what the tensions are of certain kinds of paucities of unity. Does that make sense? I mean, I don't know.
We can talk about it though later after the session.
Yeah.
But
I certainly agree with what, I don't remember if there was ultimately a question, I certainly agree with what you said about community development being linked to pacification. I've just been reading, I haven't read all of it, but part of Nikhil Singh's new book, this is like a kind of central element of it, is tracing that dual history in a way that this kind of management of racialized populations internal to countries in the global north, is especially the U.S., mirrors in all kinds of ways and reciprocally influences this kind of global pacification and policing kind of discourse. So I don't, was there a question or did, were?
It was mostly common, but also I wanted like to see that if how you see that in your work and in your argument actually when you were talking. At one point you mentioned about Camino, bringing back the Camino, the Camino identity of, and then that was that you linked it to the community organization. So,
well, it was linked for the Panthers, right? This was one of their kind of, I don't know if it was an innovation by them, but certainly a central piece of their argument was to link the situation of blacks who had migrated from the south into urban centers in the north and the west, and link their position to the positions of the Vietnamese people and popular struggles and elsewhere, so that these were both, in other words, in some sense, I don't think they used the term settler colonialism, but they were linked in some sense. I think of it as the legacies of settler colonialism shaped the management of those different populations in ways that were distinct in certain respects, but also overlapped in significant respects and influenced one another. So that, as you said, like what worked in pacifying urban centers could also be used in other global contexts. And you get all kinds of like people from, Singh talks about this, you get all kinds of like police officers, people who have run police offices, ending up in Vietnam, sort of training people how to run pacification schemes and things like that. So, which I guess also overlaps partially with this question, which I really like, about complicating the notion of the surplus population. I strongly agree with the spirit of that question. I'm not sure off the cuff, this is like, I'm just beginning to think about that, but I certainly take that question as like a really important suggestion.
So those are a rich set of questions. I'm not sure I can respond to everything that's interesting in the time we have without boring everyone, including possibly myself. Of course, I agree with everyone. as is well known to be my habit. I think the sort of the question you raised is the first question about community development. So whether they think of it as a war is an interesting one, and of course the stakes of what it means for someone to think of it as X. And as opposed to how they handle it, it's always at stake. What's interesting is they call it, but they insist on making the distinction of riot. Like they insist on calling it that, and knowing that the term riot plays into a general sense of depoliticization, such that historically in the US, right, these rioters often felt compelled to demand a political significance by saying it wasn't a riot, right? It was rebellion, it was an uprising, giving it different names, as if the name mattered. I'm not sure the name does, I mean, it matters for some people, but my project, in part, is to rearticulate it so we can just see every riot that people call a riot, whether it's participants, journalists, the government, and say, like, okay, it's a riot. Riots are political. Riots are what class struggle looks like now, and there's reasons. So I'm interested in that distinction. That said, I think I would pick sort of just add on to what you said, which is that that counterinsurgency series of strategies that comes to a head with Petraeus, right, his counterinsurgency manual, that does in fact come from non-war, from domestic pacification. So it's hard to say this starts in war and then is applied to domestic struggles. It starts in domestic struggles, is applied to war, and then returns to domestic struggles, as best I know the history. So I think you're right, at root, which is to say they understand it's war, but the struggle to depoliticize or sub-politicize it is an interesting one that I'm trying to track and sort of take issue with. To go to your set of questions, I think my argument, in a way, like my answer will always be the same. Like it changes over time. I'm actually not making so. For example, in the U.S., you get a dramatic history from the 18th century on of what I'm calling absorptive capital, which increasingly includes, right? So we can think of the chattel slavery relation as not absorptive, since they're not being absorbed into the wage, but from Reconstruction onward, we move in, like, we have a century of absorption, which comes to an end for various reasons. The ones Boggs lays out, among others, international competition is another. Brenner has a good account of this, right? So that we shift from an absorptive to a neo-colonial mode of management. I don't want to simply call it colonial because it's clearly distinct from what the Dutch do in Indonesia, right, or something like this. But a neo-colonial mode of management. And so it's certainly not the case that like racialized or marginalized populations are colonialized and so on. It's that it changes over time and people's status changes, but that shift is racialized. Right? And the shift is racialized in part because of the structure of what gets called the employment queue, right? Who gets employed first.
So just to quickly follow up quickly so I'm clear, the colonialized portion is all of that does not fall into the wage relation, or is it, what's the distinction in that space?
It's when absorption is no longer possible, to say people can't be added to the wage relation,
okay.
Other kinds of social management domination might become necessary,
sure.
And they look like modes of colonial management. Like, I have no interest in, like, are they really colonial? Are they really debates? Like, is Trump really a fascist? I want people to have fights over there about are they really. But the activities, the modes of discipline look like colonial modes of domination, for hyper-incarceration being an example.
Cool.
Now, Canada is, of course, a fantastic, interesting, and quite distinct case. I'm sure you've read Glenn's stuff, right? And that's the best of Canada, I think. But it's notably different. It lacks a dynamic between right between people brought there as chattel slaves and indigenous populations in a way that the U.S. do. And you know, one of the things I think I find most useful in Glenn's work is his response to Wilderson, which I think really depends on an American exceptionalism and particularity of the U.S. chattel slavery to give his account of the structure of ontological blackness, right? And which has a terrible account of indigeneity, like a really disastrous one. And so I think it's important to look to Canada. Among other places, as a way to think about that set of dynamics between slaves, former slaves, indigenous populations, and European settlers, and see how it plays out. So I'd rather hear your work about it than hear me ramble on. As to the last note, like, yes, of course. I mean, I think you're just saying something we all agree with, which is the category surplus population, which is becoming increasingly popular. To use as a term, the more popular it becomes, the more it disguises what's contained within it. But it's entirely about what you call informalization, right? Which you also call crime. I'm not sure I'd use the category crime, right? But I would just use secondary.
It's a specter, isn't it?
Well,
there is a lot that goes on in terms of how function seems to be. I mean, I haven't done much any work on this, but it just comes as a logical conclusion.
For me, it's a logical. Well, I don't know if it is.
Not crime. I mean, the specter of spreading into various types of like economy, which are actually in a way imposed or sanctioned by the state.
So, for me, the relevant framework would be secondary access to the wage, right? To be technical, right? So people who have a wage have primary access, but people who don't, because most of the world doesn't have unemployment insurance, right? A tiny fraction of the world has insurance for unemployment. So other people who don't have, who are pushed out of the wage or never have access to it and don't have any unemployment insurance, the dole or anything like that, have to have secondary access to the wage. There's a lot of ways to have secondary access to the wage, but that's just what informalization means, right? That's all it means, and that includes things some would call crime, right? So sex work is a crime in lots of places. But it's not, it's just secondary access to the wage. So is drug dealing. So is selling individual cigarettes on the street corner, right? Which is what Eric Garner gets killed for in New York, serving a massive riot. There's a whole category of secondary access to the wage, some of which is criminalized, much of which is criminalized, but I wouldn't call it crime, right? And for obvious political reasons. But I agree that those striations within surplus population we're going to want to hold on to as carefully as we can, the more, like, because it's now becoming a concept in bourgeois economics, where we talk about secular stagnation, which is the bourgeois framework for giving an account of this long crisis and this inability to recover people into the job market. And so it's going to become broad in discourse, and holding on to the distinctions and the striations within it that you mentioned is going to be increasingly vital.
Can I just add something?
Sure, please.
Can we just move?
He's the boss.
It's going to be very quick. I just wanted to point out that I think the notion of the fact that somebody calls it crime, I think debt in itself has a function. I think that's quite an interesting thing to consider when we think about it. That's why I use the term.
Agreed.
Yeah, and it just struck me too in listening to you that another way to come at this question of the maybe a complementary way of coming at this question of complications internal to the surplus population would be to begin with the different forms that racialization takes, right? So you go, just thinking of your question about indigeneity with Patrick Wolf's argument about how the racialization of the natives is very different than the racialization of slaves that come out of settler colonialism. And there's work on Natalia Molina's book on the way Mexicans are racialized in the U.S. It's sort of also sarwastrations in terms of relations to wage are critical, obviously. And you also would have to think through how different forms of racialization are operating in different ways in relation to different populations.
Yeah, so I must have really failed if the basic point escaped folks. I'll try to encapsulate it in a sentence. There's this important influence on Du Bois's magnum opus that has been, you know, has been acknowledged in the literature on Du Bois. I'm just trying to correct that. That was the main point. If you think Du Bois is important, if you think Black Reconstruction America is an important book, this should interest you. So that's, I think, hopefully that addresses that question. On the thornier question of how should we feel about, you know, the notion that some white dude influenced Du Bois, or so I claim, I don't think it should make us uncomfortable, unless one is sort of committed to the notion that only black people influenced Du Bois. I don't know why one would be committed to that. Again, this is a corrective. I'm not arguing that the only influence on Du Bois was Herbert. That would be absurd. Again, I mean, so Du Bois is writing in a fairly complicated intellectual context that includes, as I mentioned, you know, the folks around ASAL, but also specifically in terms of the idiosyncratic Marxism that infuses Black Reconstruction in America. I think it's a reasonable question to ask where that comes from or what some of the elements of that are. I don't think you do find that in Carter Woodson. So as important in particular, the arguments about black agency, which I don't think Du Bois got from Herbert. That's a major difference between Herbert's interpretation of the period and Du Bois's. I think he got that from his own past research and from the influences of the ASAL folks from German labor history. But around the
his
in
life.
Terms of, I'm sorry.
His life. He lived that life.
Of course. I mean, I'm not trying to negate that. That's not the point. But in terms of understanding why Du Bois engages in the most sustained Marxist rethinking of this period that any other scholar have undertaken to that point, I think I'm just trying to contextualize and historicize that. There's this dude I think the evidence shows that he had a major impact on Du Bois' rethinking. It's not the only Du Bois, it's just not an acknowledged one in the scholarship on Du Bois. Again, I don't think it demeans Du Bois. Perhaps it does cut against, though, I mean, in terms of recent intellectual history, perhaps it does cut against sort of Cedric Robinson's suggestion that there are no resources within the white Marxist intellectual tradition upon which to found the kind of project that Du Bois undertook. I think this evidence probably does cut against that. So if one takes that as read and for granted, then this might sort of make one uncomfortable. But I'd say assess my claim on the basis of evidence, not on how it makes you feel or what some others scholars have said, because I'm arguing these scholars have overlooked this.
Don't think the question is one from feeling, but it's just asking, again, and I think you've clarified that a little bit, but what is the substantive point that's to be taken from this other than saying there was this person who influenced sections A, B, C? I think you've clarified a little bit in terms of like recognizing this kind of shift in thought, but it wasn't an argument made from the suggestion that I'm uncomfortable and I think that only kind of black scholarship should be recognized in its influence. That was certainly not the intention of the question.
If it makes the medicine go down easier, Herbert wouldn't have been considered fully white at the time.
I did address that as well. Yes, thank you.
Danielle, go.
questions, comments, and research? No?
Don't feel right.
Too late.
Well, I sort of have a point for Josh, Michael, I think, is that the whole development of the Black Panther Party was extremely important to look at, and helped, I think, a lot in relation to Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and so like that as the struggle progressed. But I think it's also very important to recognize the impact it had on the larger left community in the U.S. and the world. Because, I mean, here you had a situation in the United States in the mid-1960s where the Communist Party was basically calling on people to support Johnson and the Democrats and stuff like that. And here you had emerged from within this black struggle this speech that said revolution means to overthrow the whole system. Well, that's in relation to the struggle in Vietnam and in China, the whole the Palestine struggle, this whole explosion of national liberation struggles. And it had a tremendous impact, I know, on me and a lot of other people of that generation. But I think that I'd be interested in what you think led to the demise of the Black Panther Party, because to me it looks like it wasn't a question so much as how to understand the black question, as that they ran up against the problem of how do you go forward to do what they set out to do. And then you end up with survival pending revolution. And the sort of turning inwards of, a lot of people think the Breakfast for Children program was the high point of the Black Panther Party, either developing a grassroots kind of thing. But that sort of survival pending revolution, sort of, I would think it's more like without revolution, can you survive? And now we look at the question of with the jobs moving out of the ghetto everywhere, the black population, I think, in the eyes of people like Trump, has become surplus to requirements and poses a tremendous danger to the very existence of black people in America. And the question of how they're going to resolve that, I think, is very urgent, needs urgent discussion.
Unless there are more questions or comments from anyone.
That's a great question. There's a lot in there. I don't know, obviously, that I'm going to be able to provide the correct solution to what will address that today, but a couple of thoughts to maybe start that. I mean, one, I think your first point is really important, and it's probably behind, in some sense, what I was trying to begin to think through here, that is the impact of the Panthers on the larger left in the U.S. and beyond, because one of the things that I've just ended up getting extremely irritated about is this constant concern in the U.S. about, like, the white working class, and whether, like, you know, how does the Democratic Party speak to the white working class, how do we do things so that, with the assumption that there can only be like a broad popular program if it's centered on the white working class. And I think that one of the things that interests me in this kind of idea that the Panthers are more populist is precisely, in a sense, the way in which what they did was, in a certain way, spectacular in the sense that it captured the imagination of all of these groups of people. And I think to some degree, in some ways, the situation today in the U.S. and elsewhere is such that there might be a kind of even greater potential for some kind of movement like that. That is, in very fast and loose terms, that in some sense this surplus population that needs to be more complicated and thought through.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.